ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Let's have a deep dive into vaccination, one of the most critical topics in public health, from the rapid development of COVID-19 vaccines to the ongoing battle against preventable disease. There's never been a more important time to understand where we stand and where we're heading to. Joining us tonight, Associate Professor Catherine Gibney. Catherine's an infectious diseases physician, public health expert who sits at the forefront of Australia's vaccination efforts. She's a senior clinician at the Royal Melbourne Hospital, Victorian Infectious Diseases Service. She's also a professor at the University of Melbourne's Doherty Institute, one of Australia's leading research centres for infectious diseases and immunity. And Catherine's been instrumental in shaping a lot of vaccination policy and practice throughout the COVID-19 pandemic and beyond. Catherine, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Phil.
Great to have you with us. Also joining us is Dr. Michael Wright. Michael is the president of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. He represents the thousands of GPs who deliver vaccinations at the coalface of healthcare every single day. He's also a GP himself, health economist, and adjunct associate professor at the University of New South Wales. And he's also spoken widely about pressures in general practice during and after the COVID vaccine rollout. Michael, good evening to you. He's here in the studio with me. Hi, Michael.
Good evening, Phil. Great to be with you.
Yeah, no, and likewise too. Catherine, it's been over 3 years since the October 21 lockdowns ended. Looking back at that rollout, what do you think was the biggest achievement and the biggest lesson learned?
Well, I think it's hard to choose one. Certainly the ability to develop a vaccine from an initially unknown virus and have rollouts starting within a year was remarkable. But I think, you know, that's layered alongside the government and public health response, which was really vital and obviously allowed us to hold COVID at bay or really limit spread until we had a vaccine that could be delivered. And obviously really vitally was the public willingness to go along with those public health restrictions. Mm. And without that public goodwill, we would have been had a very, very different experience of COVID.
Because I was thinking today, you know, looking back, it was October 21 when the lockdowns, ended. But remember in 2020 when all this began, and looking back now, I think people have had I'm not surprised they had some amnesia about it. It seems like we've just forgotten about it all and life's begun again in a way, hasn't it, Michael?
Yeah, well, we just sort of lived through it and thinking each day it'll hopefully end, and then it did and we started getting on with our lives and probably looking back.
Yeah. How many people got vaccinated in the end, Catherine? How did we do?
Yeah, well, I mean, nearly everyone really, in terms of adults especially, we had really very high vaccination rates, and that was one of the targets really before opening up Australia, was that we would, that we'd have really high vaccination rates. And obviously there were a lot of different strategies and some of them were controversial that went into that, but it really did permit us to open up Australia to international travel and, reduce restrictions. And even though a lot of people got COVID, we didn't have those, completely overwhelmed health systems and hospitals and, morgues in the back of trucks that we saw from North America and
Europe. I remember, at the beginning of it, I was overseas at the time, thinking and saying to friends, gee, this situation in Northern Italy doesn't look too good. Mm. I mean, there's people in, coffins lining churches, etc. I hope we don't get that. Thinking, well, little did we know.
Yeah.
Michael?
No, I mean, we were pretty fortunate even, having our borders and being able to pretty much shut the borders really did keep us safe until we could develop the vaccine.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. We at the time also, Catherine, there wasn't a vaccine. We were thinking, we didn't have one, did we?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, initially we didn't have one. It was a novel virus. So it's really remarkable that vaccines were developed so quickly. And that was really, a paradigm shift in how we approach pandemics, I think, because if we do have another one, there'll be an expectation that it'll be even quicker the next time around.
Yeah, one of the things I don't know that worries me or was concerned about is it if it rolls around again, because it will. I mean, as night follows day, it will come around again. I'm not saying soon necessarily, but we just don't know. That's the point about it. Do you think the level of compliance next time is going to be as high, Michael?
I think it's going to depend on how quickly. If it happens quickly again, I feel like we've got some issues with, I suppose, hesitancy, and we even saw that as the pandemic wore on, of people really getting fatigued from following rules. Mm. Whereas I think early on everyone was, taking it all very seriously, but as time went on, there is a lot of fatigue, and I think we're still seeing that even in vaccine rates that we've got now, which I suppose is one of the important things we need to keep looking at.
Mm. What do you think, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It depends how scary it is, I think, and when it happens. I personally was surprised at how, adherent people were to the rules. Living in Melbourne, they were pretty restrictive in terms of lockdowns that went on for a long time and kept coming back again and again, and yet people really did what they could to comply with them. I think it's natural that wanes because it's just really hard, and there's so many other things to consider, including all the economic and personal ramifications of that. So, yeah, I mean, I think if it's a really severe pandemic, then people probably will do what they can to limit spread again.
Mm. One of the things that was persistent, and it still is, is this idea that if you have a vaccination, you don't get it. And this was and is a widespread belief that if I'm vaccinated against this, I will not get it. And therefore, if I do get it, obviously the thing doesn't work. But this is because there's a misunderstanding about what vaccines are, isn't it, Michael?
And I think that's one of the things that often you have a conversation with patients about it, that you'll say, we're giving you this vaccine so that hopefully you build up some immunity to this virus, so that means if you then get exposed to the full virus, you'll get a lot milder case. Hopefully none, but ideally a milder case. But importantly, you're going to be a lot less able to transmit it to other people. And we're always worried about vulnerable people. So, typically kids, older people. That's one of the messages I often give to my patients is say, we are vaccinating you, but the benefit is for you and your loved ones as well.
I mean, this is the thing, isn't it, Catherine? Because, alongside that one is that, it doesn't work all the time anyway, is an associated belief. If it's a risk, why shouldn't I be allowed to take the risk? In other words, I don't believe I'm going to get it, so I'll just take the risk. And this also, at the heart of that lies a misunderstanding about what vaccines are for too, isn't it, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, just like infections, viruses and bacteria, vaccines, there's a real spectrum of them, and some of them do protect you against infection and, develop what we call a sterilising immunity, and you don't get the infection, you don't spread it, and that's great. But a lot of vaccines, really their function is to reduce the risk of severe disease. So, yes, you're a bit less likely to get infected, but it really does. The real power of it is to keep you out of hospital and prevent death. So that's certainly the case with COVID vaccines. And the vaccine program was all about, stopping severe illness, stopping people getting into hospital, protecting our health systems so they didn't become overwhelmed and, people could still turn up and get treated for everything else. Mm-hmm. But really didn't, obviously, stop all infections, because even after being vaccinated, a lot of people got COVID, but thankfully pretty mild disease.
Yeah. One of my texters says, I had my shingles vax recently. Michael, maybe you want to take this one on. I had my shingles vax recently and had a local reaction about 1 week later. Went to my doctor. He suggested not having the second shot, usually within 6 months. My question is, will I still be protected?
Well, I think you'll get more of your immunity from your first one, and then maybe you'll spread it out, because it's sort of between 2 and 6 months for getting your booster. So if you've had that stronger reaction, then you might sort of go to longer towards those 6 months. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, Catherine, what you think. I'd probably keep
getting the second one. Should he have the second one?
I'd be really reluctant to give advice for an individual, but yeah, I guess it really depends on the reaction. There's fairly few reactions that are bad enough to say you shouldn't get a second one, but I know for shingles, people do experience significant reactions, and actually quite a few people don't turn up for their second shot because it hurts. But as Michael said, you get better and more prolonged immunity if you can turn up for your second shot.
One of my texters says, I'm over 70. I had the recommended shingles vaccination just over a year ago. Despite that, I recently had shingles. How did that happen?
Yep. As you say, none of these are foolproof, but you're really trying to reduce the getting a serious case of it or something that will make you quite
unwell. How good at it is? It's reasonably good, though, this one, the shingles one, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know the numbers exactly, Catherine, but it seems pretty effective.
I mean, it's better than the flu one, for example, which is not that good.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the protection is much higher, and it also protects against the post shingles or post hepatic neuralgia, which is that really horrible prolonged pain that some people get in the area of shingles. So, that's one of the real advantages. And now there's actually emerging data to suggest it protects against dementia. So that is an even bigger win if that holds out to be true.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. What's happened to COVID, Catherine? I mean, there's a feeling that it's gone away, hasn't it? Even though it hasn't. People get infections these days, and I wonder whether anyone tests so much anymore for it. What's happened? Where is it?
Yeah, so I think you're right. I mean, it's moved from being a pandemic, and the thing about it being a new or novel virus was that none of us had immunity to it pre-vaccination. And now we're in a situation where pretty much everyone's been vaccinated and had COVID. So we have a lot of immunity. So we call that hybrid immunity if it's both from vaccine and natural infection. And so that doesn't mean you'll never get COVID again, but it does mean that you're much less likely to get severe disease and end up in hospital. And so we actually are not seeing that much COVID in our hospitals anymore. There's not a huge amount of severe disease. Certainly cases
Why is that? Where has it gone?
Well, it hasn't gone anywhere. There are still cases, but our immunity is such that we're protected against severe disease. So it's now an endemic disease. It will continue circulating. It's not going to go anywhere. But in the current status with the current strains and our level of immunity in the population, it's not causing huge issues for the health system or at the population level.
Hmm. I've kept up my annual COVID vaccination since I had the first one. Well, ever since I moved on to the mRNA one. I started out on the, what was it called again? The original one we had. AstraZeneca one. And I think I'll have it. I mean, I will have it again this year. But does the effects that you're describing, Catherine, is this because people have kept up vaccinations, or does the virus simply not have the sort of foothold that it had?
Well, a bit of both. So, as with during the pandemic, still the people who are at highest risk of severe disease. It's really age based. So, the older you are, the more likely you are to have severe disease. So there's certainly very strong recommendations that people over 75 get vaccinated.
Every year?
Preferably twice a year, actually.
Okay. Every 6 months.
And then from 65, that everyone 65 and above would get an annual vaccine. And then, some younger adults based on their other health conditions. But there's not strong recommendations that all adults get COVID vaccine every year. So, and that just reflects the change in the risk of severe disease as we've transitioned away from this, naive, non-immune population through to a population that really has quite a lot of immunity.
But, Michael, you're saying if you're over 65, you should definitely have it once a year.
Yeah, the recommendation is sort of every year. Yeah, you get your booster and then over 75, even every 6 months.
Okay. If you're under 65, what?
You can offer it, so sort of adult, but there's less urgency for those younger people because they're less likely to get severe infections.
Mm. See, I suppose my question is why? Because after all, you know, people died of this.
Well, I mean, one of the things I find in my practice now is, you know, if someone comes in with a cold or an infection, often I will do a RAT, but you do the RAT for the influenza, COVID and RSV, often sort of you do them all in one test and then you're able to tell people if they've got COVID. So I still do see people reasonably frequently with COVID, but it's that sort of presentation. And most of them, it's almost like a cold for them. So they go, okay, I've got this again, tell them to go home, and most people sort of recover within a couple of days.
Yeah, so it's, in other words, it's not the, it's for most people, it's not actually a serious infection anymore.
Yeah, well, we've all got some, as Catherine said, this hybrid immunity, which has given us this protection, which means it's particularly the current strains don't overwhelm us like the earlier versions.
What's happened, Catherine, to the virus? Because at the time there was a lot of thought that, you know, it will just mutate viciously into this, you know, horrendous thing that we will not be able to control. What do we know about the virus now?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's continued to evolve, not as quickly or as frighteningly as we, you know, initially. But in fact, and so the vaccines have continued to evolve as well. So that, you know, one of the good things about the mRNA vaccines is that they can be adapted, and they have been. And so the vaccine manufacturers adapt their vaccines to the most up-to-date virus. Now, that means we're always chasing a little bit, but they're close enough that they're still effective. So, you know, the public probably wouldn't notice, but we have moved through a few different iterations of COVID vaccines across the last couple of years.
And he says, is shingles contagious? Michael?
Is shingles contagious? So you can catch chickenpox from the pustules that you get with chickenpox. So it's basically, the pustules you get with shingles, it's basically reactivated chickenpox. So you can actually spread it to someone who's not immune to chickenpox. Luckily, kids are vaccinated now, so the risk of that is a lot lower. So you can catch chickenpox from shingles if you're not vaccinated, but you can't catch shingles from shingles. So a bit confusing.
Okay. So if you're with if you're with people who've got shingles, you're not going to catch shingles from Okay, but if you've got shingles,
you can,
and you're hanging around with kids who haven't been vaccinated against chickenpox,
which
shouldn't happen.
No, exactly. So they should be immune, but you can still pass it on.
Yeah. Okay. 1-300-800-222 is the number if you would like to grab a line. Line's free. You will get through if you want one. Brian from St James in WA. G'day, Brian.
Yeah. How you going, Phil? And good evening to you, Kathy. Just wondering if you'll know anything about the Epstein-Barr virus.
The Epstein-Barr virus? Yep. Okay.
Yep.
What do you want to know about it, Brian?
Well, just apparently it causes a few diseases, so I'm wondering what the background is there.
Okay. Michael?
Catherine, I might pan this one over to you, EBV.
Yeah, so, I mean, EBV is the cause of what we commonly call glandular fever. Illness that causes fever and can make people feel really exhausted for a period of time. Often it's, you know, teenagers and young adults who get it. It's called the kissing virus. But it is also associated with some long-term health conditions. So it's not that everyone who gets EBV develops these, but there's an association with some types of cancer and with, I think, multiple sclerosis. So those things that are sort of being looked into and studied more, but that's an example of a virus where if we did get an effective vaccine, it might have some significant downstream health benefits.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, Brian.
Thank you very much.
No worries. 1-300-800-222. John at Coburg says, Phil, a lot of vaccine resistance comes from people who were very active in the gym scene, and it was head-scratching. They were reluctant to, quote, put foreign chemicals into my body. This was a big thing, wasn't it? But they were quite comfortable injecting supplements and steroids of dubious quality and even more dubious provenance. I never understood this. This foreign chemicals into the body view, Catherine, has, if anything, got stronger, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think... obviously, people have, some people have always had questions about vaccines before COVID and then during the pandemic. You know, there was a lot of talk about vaccines. There was a lot of push for people to be vaccinated. And I think, you know, vaccine confidence has been affected during COVID and since then. And that's really been seen with some unfortunate reductions in childhood vaccine coverage, which is something we really want to maintain. So, yeah, I think it's really about understanding that vaccines, a lot of work goes into ensuring, testing, monitoring their safety right through, you know, when during development, but also when they're being used in the community, that, you know, as, if any signals are seen, then they're really taken very seriously and looked at. So, unlike some of the other things that people consume or inject or use that really don't have such rigorous arrangements and monitoring around them. So, yeah, it's a real thing, but sometimes it does make you scratch your head a little bit.
Yeah, Scott says, should we vaccinate against COVID if we're travelling to parts of Europe in the European summer, e.g. Italy and Portugal in June? Sounds like a good trip, Scott. What, Michael, the answer would be?
Well, I think it's about age-related too, you know. Yeah. So if you're over 65, probably think about it seriously. You know, you'd recommend you do it, each year. Younger people, not necessarily recommending it. But you don't want to get anything when you're on your holidays. So, you know, so I'm not going to say, no, don't get it if you rock up.
Yeah. Louise says, should you have the COVID and flu shots at the same time? Last year I had them together, same arm, and 7 days later I came down with influenza A. I'm 63.
Oh, that doesn't sound nice. No, look, we typically give them at the same time. You sort of, when you've got people there, I'll try to do the two at once.
Do it once, that's something I must say, that's what I've had. Here's a question. John says, Catherine, this is probably for you. How will the USA pushing back against child vaccinations affect the world?
Negatively, I would say, unfortunately. And that really feeds into that vaccine confidence that we mentioned earlier. And I think it's, you know, unfortunately, there's possibly some strategy behind undermining confidence in vaccines and undermining confidence in the childhood vaccine schedule. And so we just have to be really careful in Australia that we follow the science and try and really make sure that we maintain our really fantastic vaccine schedule and vaccine program that we have.
It's still pretty good for kids, isn't it, in Australia? I mean, but I get a sense that it's declined. Yeah. Has it, Michael?
I mean, we're up to over 95% sort of back in 2020.
What have we been at?
Well, that was when we hit the peaks at the peak of COVID, that were actually the childhood vaccinations went right up. And I think there was, you know, major trust there that people said, okay, this is good, you know, we'll get this vaccination. And some of this sort of information from overseas, it's kind of eroding. You know, people are going, you know, I'm not quite so sure. So that's making it a bit harder for us to, you know, I'm having more conversations with patients now, you know, just in making sure that they do go ahead and get their vaccines. And often people are coming in with more questions, which, whether it's social media, whether it's what's happening in the States, but just trying to, I suppose, explain to people what the evidence shows about the value of these vaccines, I think is, you know, a really important thing, but something that we need to keep pushing.
We've had measles in Australia and we've had more whooping cough outbreaks than I remember when I started as a broadcaster. Why is that?
Well, we've had the biggest whooping cough, or the highest incidence of whooping cough cases for 25 years last year.
This kills children. It's really serious, isn't it?
Yeah. And so the good news is that children are vaccinated, so at sort of 6 to 8 weeks, kids get it, and there's sort of at 2, 4, and 6 months. Yeah. But also pregnant women are now getting vaccinated against whooping cough. So, you know, infants are the people who we're most worried about.
Why are we seeing so much more of it then?
I might throw that one to Catherine. Ali, I don't know why. We have sort of had a series over about 2 to 3 years of increasing cases. Now, we are testing more. So, you know, that's one thing, that we're actually finding more cases. But there definitely is more circulating in the community.
What about measles?
I know we have had some cases of measles, which have come from overseas, so people who haven't been vaccinated.
But we haven't had a homegrown outbreak of measles, have we?
Not that I know. No, I don't think we've had any sort of internal transmission.
Yeah. Thank heavens.
I know, exactly.
Catherine, because in the United States they have, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. You know, the UK and the US, a lot of countries have had really big outbreaks of measles, and we haven't had a big outbreak. Our vaccination rates are still pretty good, but that that drop in childhood vaccinations is concerning, particularly for measles, because it's so infectious that we really do need our vaccination rates to be about 95% to achieve what we call herd immunity for measles. Mm-hmm. And there is a risk, and, you know, we haven't had big outbreaks, but there have been cases in Victoria, you know, in the last week or two of people who haven't travelled. So it's here, and people who either have not been vaccinated or have only received one dose are at risk.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Angela from Melbourne. G'day, Angela.
Yes.
Yeah. Hi, Angela. What's your question?
I was just would like to know a bit about myositis. I've got some symptoms, and I've got some like aching muscles in my upper arms and weakness in my legs.
Yeah.
And I've got the lungs, scarring on the lungs.
Okay.
And I think that I might have the myositis.
Well, let's ask Michael.
I've had it.
Let's ask Michael.
I mean, that could be a range of things then. So have you seen your GP about it?
I have seen a GP, and I've had a liver function test, and my enzymes are up.
Oh, okay.
And I've just had a ultrasound of the liver, and I haven't got the results yet. But I'm getting them tomorrow, and I just thought, should I have a muscle biopsy after that or what?
Well, I think I'd probably wait till you get your results tomorrow, but good luck with that. That's, that can be, quite debilitating. I'm sorry to hear the pain.
Yep. Check it in with your GP, Angela. Thank you. 1-300-800-222 is the number. What do you think about the anti-vax movement at the moment, Catherine? Do you think it's grown, or was it? Did it have its moment in the sun during and post-COVID, or do you think it's – because in the United States it's actually grown, hasn't it?
I guess I probably wouldn't characterise most people as being anti-vax. In fact, I think really they're not. I think what's happened is that that people and I guess for childhood vaccines, parents' vaccine confidence is slipping a little bit. Just in the last week or so, there's been a national survey released, some information, and even in 2025 compared to 2024, parents have less confidence in vaccines, and the lower vaccination rates seem to be related more to acceptance than access. So when we talk about access barriers, we're talking about, you know, having difficulty getting to the GP or it being expensive or not being able to take time off work. And that hasn't changed, but what's changed is that people's belief and feeling about vaccine and trust in vaccines has slipped a little bit.
Yeah. Sue says, I was given the MMR, that's measles, mumps, rubella, at 6 years old. I'm now 70. Am I still covered?
So you need two doses of MMR to be fully covered, but also people who, I can't do my maths, the people who were born before 1964, we just consider them to be immune because there was quite a lot of measles circulating before vaccines came into widespread use. So either you were born before that time, or you really need to have two doses. So if someone doesn't have documentation of two doses, then they can see their healthcare provider
and get it,
about
and get
getting it.
Margaret from Adelaide. Hi, Margaret.
Oh, hello. Look, I'm asking a question about COVID.
Yeah.
What about those children who were too young to have a COVID injection? For example, I've got grandsons who are almost 12, and they've never had a COVID injection because it wasn't available to young ones, and they'd never had COVID. What's their situation?
What's the story here, Catherine or Michael?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment there's not a recommendation for children to get COVID vaccines unless they're severely immunocompromised.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that unlike some other, you know, quite a lot of other diseases, COVID tended to be milder in children. Not to say that some didn't, you know, get severe disease, but really overwhelmingly, the older you got, the more severe the disease is. So it may well be that quite a few children who haven't obviously been very sick have in fact been exposed to COVID and had a really mild infection.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I also want to ask, there's a lot of young people who'd be coming up to, like another grandson, 18, 19, who really probably only were able to have one because it wasn't offered to teenagers that much either.
No. Is that still the case, Mike?
Yeah. No, that's what I mean, that the kids don't really seem to get that affected by it.
By COVID. So, I mean, it remained really, wasn't a killer of...
Of the older people.
Yeah.
You know, but certainly it's not the case for a lot of the other vaccines. You know, lots of really important vaccines that we want to immunise babies and infants against.
Mm. When are we going to develop a better flu vaccine, Catherine? Because the current one's rubbish, isn't it? I'll withdraw that. It's not. It's not that effective, though. I mean, it's. I think. What are you? I mean, at best, be better to be about 50%, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it does vary year to year because the strain of flu that circulates varies, and so you know, each year or each 6 months, the WHO sort of meets and decides, or you know, obviously a group of them meet and decide which vaccine strains should be included in the next vaccine. Sometimes it matches well and is, you know, has higher effectiveness. Sometimes it's less well matched. But, you know, around 50% is not unusual. And that's in terms of keeping people out of hospital. So, again, that's the main thing we're trying to do is to keep people and particularly the most vulnerable. So flu vaccine is recommended pretty broadly, but it's funded for 6 months to 5 years of age and also over 65, plus some other groups depending on risk. They're the groups that really focus the vaccine on it. And you're right, it doesn't keep everyone out of hospital, but it certainly reduces severe disease.
Talk to me about herd immunity, Michael.
So herd immunity.
This is widely misunderstood, I think.
Well, this is the idea that we have to vaccinate as many as the population as possible, and that'll actually keep
the incidence of the disease
people
low.
Who can't be vaccinated safe. So typically, we sort of set this figure in Australia at about 95%, that if we vaccinate 95% of the population, the remaining people who either can't or aren't vaccinated will be protected. So that's kind of been the standard for a long time.
I mean, the idea of it is, isn't it, that that's right, that if you do this, you're helping everybody.
Yeah. So you're vaccinating to protect yourself, your family, and also the community.
Yeah. Yeah, because the disease is unlikely to get a widespread foothold
if a lot
of people have been vaccinated against it. Yeah, even if some people do get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's a thing.
It's an interesting one.
It gets back to this question I asked you at the beginning that I think a lot of people don't find is, you know, if I'm vaccinated, why do I get it?
Yeah.
Because sometimes you do.
Exactly. And that's the thing. Yeah, you're not going to be 100% protected. But hopefully if you do get it, you'll get a milder case. And you won't be able to spread it as far.
Yeah. Graham from Perth. G'day, Graham.
Oh, g'day, Philip and guests. My question is, can shingles cause blindness?
Can shingles cause blindness?
Shingles cause blindness. I would have thought that's a very rare, but I might give you that one, Catherine. Is that? I've not.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's rare, but yes. If it's along the nerves
optic
that nerve. Look at your, you know, go to your eye, it can. And that can be really, you know, obviously something that's a bit of a medical emergency just to try and get on top of that and protect, preserve people's vision.
Okay. Sorry, Graham, is that helpful?
That's excellent. I had a neighbour that had it all over his face and body, and he was immediately rushed to hospital for that particular reason. Yeah. They said he could go blind.
Yeah. Okay. Greg from Lismore. Hi, Greg.
How you going?
Not bad.
I was just wondering if there's any, like people who have had heart disease and had the COVID, sort of, there's the link with increased dementia, especially in older people.
Catherine, is there a link between COVID vaccinations and increased dementia in older people?
No. As in the vaccine causing dementia, there's not. There's certainly a link between COVID disease and heart disease. I don't know if that was the initial part of the question. But as I said, some vaccines and shingles being sort of the one that we're most interested in at the moment actually seem to protect against dementia. So maybe there's something about the illness, the infection, that can trigger or progress dementia.
Hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Greg. One of my texters says, climate change and vaccines, it's all manufactured BS. If only it were so. If only it were so. Mm. My texter says, hi, I had five COVID vaccines and got COVID twice, but the second time was not as bad.
I think I was about the same. Yeah. I've had it a couple of times and I'm sure I've had five or six vaccines.
Yeah.
It got milder each time.
I shouldn't say this on the radio, but I have never had it.
Wow. You're the one. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. There's quite a few people, aren't there, Catherine, who've never had it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's people who don't know they've had it. You'd have to have a blood test to try and work out, and that can actually be pretty difficult to interpret in someone who's vaccinated. But I actually had COVID pre-vaccines, and that was certainly my worst bout of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Well, how come you didn't race straight out and get the AstraZeneca, Catherine?
Oh, I did. I was working on the COVID wards in 2020 before we had
them. Oh, okay, right. Okay. So. You're forgiven. That's right. Yes, well, brave people, exactly. 1-800-222 if you'd like to give us a call, 1-300-800-222. Text line 0467-922-702. Ian from Grafton. Hi, Ian.
Hello there.
Hi. Hi, Ian. What's your question?
Well, about 8 years ago, I had picked up a virus called cytomegalovirus, and that
CMV
created a lot of angst and. Mm-hmm. It was into my right eye, so therefore I had three uncomfortable years having a couple of corneal grafts.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a nasty virus, that CMV there, Ian. It sounds like, and it's not one that we hear stories like that commonly, but it can be quite dangerous.
Hmm.
I don't think there's a vaccine for that one, though, is there, Catherine? I don't.
It's one of the ones that's been in development and hasn't quite made it all the way through. The main interest in CMV vaccines is actually for pregnant women and trying to prevent deafness in their babies. It can have really nasty outcomes like the one you describe.
Okay.
Well, I am taking tablets every night for it called valacyclovir.
Antiviral medication. Good. I presume
that's the right thing to be doing,
Michael. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Ian. Can we talk about the future, Francis? One of the problems that really worried everyone at the time was that we had no sovereign manufacturing capacity for vaccines against COVID, and indeed our manufacturing capacity for vaccines generally wasn't that great. Where are we now?
So I guess for a long time we've had CSL as a onshore manufacturing and they were involved in the AstraZeneca manufacturing vaccine, but we didn't have any mRNA. Now there is an mRNA facility in Melbourne and the hope is that they'll be able to produce and sort of fill and send out up to 1 million doses of vaccine a year.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't sort of started yet. I mean, I think the factory's up and running and got the regulatory approval, but as far as I'm aware, they're not sort of producing and pushing out vaccines at this moment. But they'd be looking at, I guess, flu, RSV and COVID mRNA vaccines.
Mm. Is the RSV vaccine free, Michael?
Which one?
The RSV.
It is for, well, so there is a one for pregnant women.
Hmm.
So there's, that one's covered, but it, there are other vaccines for older people as well, but they're not all, some of them are fairly expensive.
Hmm. So, Catherine, are you saying that we are likely to be better placed in the event of a future crisis to manufacture these things ourselves? And I suppose my subsidiary question is mRNA technology likely to be the go-to technology for making vaccines into the future?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be the only technology. And I think one of the good things about Australia at the moment, or now, as opposed to a few years ago, is that we have a couple of different platforms that we're able to produce vaccines on. I think the real benefit of mRNA is how quickly adaptable it is for vaccine production. So if there's another pandemic, that may well be the type of vaccine that once again can be developed and produced quickly and, you know, fairly cheaply. But I think it's important that we don't put all our eggs in the mRNA basket. It's likely that we're going to need a whole range of different vaccine platforms in the future.
Mm. Please explain why grandparents require whooping cough vaccine to see their grandchildren. I have not seen that age group having whooping cough. Please advise, says Judy. Michael?
Once again, it's one of those ones if you're trying to protect the grandkids more than the older people. So so pregnant women have the whooping cough vaccine, when pregnant mums, when they're before they deliver. So they've got immunity that they're giving to their kids. And the idea is that also by vaccinating the grandparents and other people in close contact, you're protecting those, you know, precious babies when they don't have much immunity.
Because most adults wouldn't normally have whooping cough vaccinations, would they?
Whooping cough
vaccinations.
Well, I mean, interestingly, the whooping cough, it's often delivered with tetanus. So you can get when you get a tetanus booster, you can also get a whooping cough at the same time. Not all of them.
Okay.
But so increasingly, that's what I find I'm offering is getting people to have their tetanus and their whooping cough at the same time.
So speaking of tetanus, actually, this is I reckon this is one of the ones that people let go by, don't they?
Yep.
Tell us about how often you should have this.
So every 10 years still. Okay. So, yep. If you've got a tetanus-prone wound, it's 5 years, so obviously a deep cut. And we've had cases, you know, where people have been out in the garden, older people out in the garden who haven't had immunity, and they've had caught tetanus and with, like, tragic consequences.
Mm. Michael, from the AstraZeneca vaccine was withdrawn, wasn't it, Catherine, because there were some issues with it, weren't there?
It wasn't withdrawn, but a preference was made for the mRNA vaccines, and then eventually we didn't have any more left. So it wasn't like the TGA said this isn't safe and we're taking it off the shelves.
I thought there was some, they've discovered that there is an extremely rare complication in some cases.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, we did know there was, we obviously observed the rare complication that occurred with AstraZeneca vaccine, and tragically there a small number of people died from it in Australia. But there has been some recent research published sort of really drilling down into exactly what caused that and what sort of genetic variant was in those people who had that very severe reaction. But, you know, and hopefully that, you know, can make vaccines safer in the future.
Yeah. Therese from Castle Hill. Hi, Therese.
Oh, hello. Look, I've heard that the shingles virus protects you or gives immunity from dementia. But is there an optimum age at which you should have it? Because I've had to wait. I've had the previous shingles vaccination, and I've had to wait 5 years before I could have it.
Michael?
So we have had this sort of crossover. There was an older shingles vaccine called Zostavax, and we've now moved on to this newer version that is more effective. But there have been some recommendations of not having
for which I had to
together.
Pay a lot of money, Michael, but now it's free.
Yeah, that's what you're saying. Now it's free, yeah.
But it is. What's it called again? It's called
Shingrix.
Shingrix, yeah. That's right. So if you haven't had Shingrix and you're older, you should get it.
Yep.
Yeah. Mark from Adelaide. G'day, Mark.
Great, are you just? I've never had COVID. I've had four of the vaccines.
Yeah.
I was wondering, are the vaccines still free?
Michael?
COVID vaccine. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Have you? Lovely. I'll have to book in to get another one.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I've had almost all of mine through the chemist. Michael, is that the most common? Do you give them out or?
Yeah, like we do them in general practice all the time. And yeah. So it is convenient having it from you, being able to get it from your chemist. And I think going to see your GP, you obviously can get your other things sorted out as well.
Mm. Yeah, 1-300-800-222. Why is there not a vaccine for Ross River virus yet? Says John from Mudgee.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Catherine, is there one?
Well, I think one's been developed, but, you know, a lot goes into, well, as in has been one developed in, you know, the research space, but there's a lot that goes into vaccines actually making it through clinical trials and manufacturing, and one of them is, you know, whether it's cost-effective, and I suspect for Ross River it might not be, just because there's probably not a huge number of cases. So it's sort of balancing the how common and how severe the diseases are, and maybe Ross River hasn't met that threshold for the vaccine.
Yeah. In summary, because time has beaten us, you should have, if you're over 65, get COVID once a year, maybe twice if you're over 75. Michael, is that correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
Get your flu shot.
Get your flu shot. Don't expect too much out of it.
But, you know, hopefully it'll make you less sick.
That's
hopefully
true.
You transmit it less. Get your shingles vaccine if you're
over 65. Get your shingles vaccine if you're over 65 and make sure your tetanus is up to date.
That's a good start.
Mm. Thank you to both of you. Catherine, terrific to have your expertise as well. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Associate Professor Catherine Gibney is an infectious diseases physician and public health expert from Royal Melbourne. And Dr. Michael Wright's been with us, health economist and president of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. He's a GP and has given quite a few shots over the years himself. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Phil.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And thanks for the calls and texts as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.